Chapter 3. White Noise. Heard melodies are sweet, but those unheard are sweeter. From John Keats' Ode on a Grecian Urn, 1820. The cruelest lies are often told in silence. Robert Louis Stevenson, Virginibus Purisque, 1881. The pulses had been journeying for years through the great dark between the stars. Occasionally they would intercept an irregular cloud of gas and dust, and a little of the energy would be absorbed or scattered. The remainder continued in the original direction. Ahead of them was a faint yellow glow, slowly increasing in brightness among the other unvarying lights. Now, although to human eyes it would still be a point, it was by far the brightest object in the black sky. The pulses were encountering a horde of giant snowballs. Entering the Argus administration building was a willowy woman in her late 30s. Her eyes, large and set far apart, served to soften the angular bone structure of her face. Her long dark hair was loosely gathered by a tortoise barrette at the nape of her neck. Casually dressed in a knit T-shirt and khaki skirt, she strolled along a hallway on the first floor and entered a door marked E. Adaway, Director. As she removed her thumb from the fingerprint deadlock, an observer might have noticed a ring on her right hand, with an oddly milky red stone unprofessionally set in it. Turning on a desk lamp, she rummaged through a drawer, finally producing a pair of earphones. Briefly illuminated on the wall beside her desk was a quotation from the Parables of Franz Kafka. "Now the sirens have a still more fatal weapon than their song, namely their silence. Someone might possibly have escaped from their singing, but from their silence, certainly never." Extinguishing the light with a wave of her hand, she made for the door in the semi-darkness. In the control room, she quickly reassured herself that all was in order. Through the window, she could see a few of the 131 radio telescopes that stretched for tens of kilometers across the New Mexico scrub desert, like some strange species of mechanical flower straining towards the sky. It was early afternoon, and she had been up late the night before. Radio astronomy can be performed during daylight because the air does not scatter radio waves from the sun as it does ordinary visible light. To a radio telescope pointing anywhere but very close to the sun, the sky is pitch black, except for the radio sources. Beyond the Earth's atmosphere, on the other side of the sky, is a universe teeming with radio emissions. By studying radio waves, you can learn about planets and stars and galaxies, about the composition of great clouds of organic molecules that drift between the stars, about the origin and evolution and fate of the universe. But all these radio emissions are natural, caused by physical processes, electrons spiraling in the galactic magnetic field, or interstellar molecules colliding with one another, or the remote echoes of the Big Bang, red shifted from gamma rays at the origin of the universe to the tame and chill radio waves that fill in all of space in our epoch. In the scant few decades in which humans have pursued radio astronomy, there has never been a real signal from the depths of space. Something manufactured, something artificial, something contrived by an alien mind. Oh, there have been false alarms. The regular time variation of the radio emissions from quasars, and especially pulsars, had at first been thought tentatively, tremulously, to be a kind of announcement signal from someone else. Or perhaps a radio navigation beacon for exotic ships that plied the spaces between the stars. But they had turned out to be something else. Equally exotic, perhaps, as a signal from beings in the night sky. Quasars seemed to be stupendous sources of energy, perhaps connected with massive black holes at the centers of galaxies. many of them observed more than halfway back in time to the origin of the universe. Pulsars are rapidly spinning atomic nuclei, the size of a city. And there had been other rich and mysterious messages that had turned out to be intelligent after a fashion, but not very extraterrestrial. The skies were now peppered with secret military radar systems and radio communication satellites that were beyond the entreaty of a few civilian radio astronomers. Sometimes they were real outlaws, ignoring international telecommunications agreements. There were no recourses and no penalties. Occasionally, all nations denied responsibility. But there had never been a clear-cut alien signal. And yet the origin of life now seemed to be so easy. And there were so many planetary systems, so many worlds, and so many billions of years available for biological evolution, that it was hard to believe the galaxy was not teeming with life and intelligence. Project Argus was the largest facility in the world dedicated to the radio search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Radio waves travelled with the speed of light, faster than which nothing, it seemed, could go. They were easy to generate and easy to detect. Even very backward technological civilizations like that on Earth would stumble on radio early in their exploration of the physical world. Even with the rudimentary radio technology available, now only a few decades after the invention of the radio telescope, it was nearly possible to communicate with an identical civilization at the center of the galaxy. But there were so many places in the sky to examine, and so many frequencies on which an alien civilization might be broadcasting, that it required a systematic and patient observing program. Argus had been in full operation for more than 4 years. There had been glitches, bogies, intimations, false alarms, but no message. "Afternoon, Dr. Arroway." The lone engineer smiled pleasantly at her, and she nodded back. All 131 telescopes of Project Argus were controlled by computers. The system slowly scanned the sky on its own, checking that there were no mechanical or electronic breakdowns, comparing the data from different elements of the array of telescopes. She glanced at the billion-channel analyzer, a bank of electronics covering a whole wall, and at the visual display of the spectrometer. There was not really very much for the astronomers and technicians to do, as the telescope array over the years slowly scanned the sky. If it detected something of interest, it would automatically sound an alarm, alerting project scientists in their beds at night if need be. Then Arroway would go into high gear to determine if this one was an instrumental failure or some American or Soviet space bogey. Together with the engineering staff, she would devise ways of improving the sensitivity of the equipment. Was there any pattern, any regularity in the emission? She would delegate some of the radio telescopes to examine exotic astronomical objects that had been recently detected by other observatories. She would help staff members and visitors with projects unrelated to SETI. She would fly to Washington to keep interest high at the funding agency, the National Science Foundation. She would give a few public talks on Project Argus at the Rotary Club in Socorro or the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque, and occasionally greet an enterprising reporter who would arrive, sometimes unannounced, in remotest New Mexico. Ellie had to take care that the tedium did not engulf her. Her co-workers were pleasant enough, but even apart from the impropriety of a close personal relationship with a nominal subordinate, she did not find herself tempted into any real intimacies. There had been a few brief, torrid, but fundamentally casual relationships with local men, unconnected with the Argus project. In this area of her life, too, a kind of ennui, a lassitude, had settled over her. She sat down before one of the consoles and plugged in the earphones. It was futile, she knew. A conceit to think that she, listening on one or two channels, would detect a pattern, when the vast computer system monitoring a billion channels had not. But it gave her a modest illusion of utility. She leaned back, eyes half closed, an almost dreamy expression enveloping the contours of her face. "She's really quite lovely," the technician permitted himself to think. She heard, as always, a kind of static, a continuous, echoing, random noise. Once, when listening to a part of the sky that included the star AC+793888 in Cassiopeia, she felt she heard a kind of singing, fading tantalizingly in and out, lying just beyond her ability to convince herself that there was something really there. This was the star towards which the Voyager 1 spacecraft, now in the vicinity of the orbit of Neptune, would ultimately travel. The spacecraft carried a golden phonograph record on which were impressed greetings, pictures, and songs from Earth. Could they be sending us their music at the speed of light, while we're sending ours to them only 1/10,000th as fast? At other times, like now, when the static was clearly patternless, she would remind herself of Shannon's famous dictum in information theory that the most efficiently coded message was indistinguishable from noise, unless you had the key to the encoding beforehand. Rapidly she pressed a few keys on the console before her and played two of the narrow band frequencies against each other, one in each earphone, nothing. She listened to the two planes of polarization of the radio waves and then to the contrast between linear and circular polarization. There were a billion channels to choose from. You could spend your life trying to outguess the computer, listening with pathetically limited human ears and brains, seeking a pattern. Humans are good, she knew, at discerning subtle patterns that are really there, but equally so at imagining them when they're altogether absent. There would be some sequence of pulses, some configuration of the static, that would for an instant give a syncopated beat or a brief melody. She switched to a pair of radio telescopes that were listening to a known galactic radio source. She heard a glissander down the radio frequencies, a whistler, due to the scattering of radio waves by electrons and the tenuous interstellar gas between the radio source and the Earth. The more pronounced the glissander, the more electrons were in the way, and the further the source was from the Earth. She had done this so often that she was able, just from hearing a radio whistler for the first time, to make an accurate judgment of its distance. This one, she estimated, was about 1,000 light-years away, far beyond the local neighbourhood of stars, but still well within the great Milky Way galaxy. Ellie returned to the sky survey mode of Project Argus. Again, no pattern. It was like a musician listening to the rumble of a distant thunderstorm. The occasional small patches of pattern would pursue her and intrude themselves into her memory with such insistence that sometimes she was forced to go back to the tapes of a particular observing run to see if there was something that her mind had caught and the computers had missed. All her life, dreams had been her friends. Her dreams were unusually detailed, well-structured, colourful. She was able to peer closely at her father's face, say, or the back of an old radio set, and the dream would oblige with full visual details. She had always been able to recall her dreams down to the fine details, except for the times when she had been under extreme pressure, as before her PhD oral exam, or when she and Jesse were breaking up. But now she was having difficulty in recalling the images in her dreams. And, disconcertingly, she began to dream sounds, as people do who are blind from birth. In the early morning hours, her unconscious mind would generate some theme or ditty that she'd never heard before. She would wake up, give an audible command to the light on her night table, pick up the pen she'd put there for the purpose, draw a staff, and commit the music to paper. Sometimes after a long day, she would play it on her recorder, and wonder if she'd heard it in Ophiuchus or Capricorn. She was, she would admit to herself ruefully, being haunted by the electrons and the moving holes that inhabit receivers and amplifiers, and by the changed particles and magnetic fields of the cold, thin gas between the flickering distant stars. It was a repeated single note, high-pitched and raucous around the edges. It took her a moment to recognize it. Then she was sure she hadn't heard it in 35 years. It was the metal pulley, on the clothesline that would complain each time her mother gave a tug and put out another freshly washed smock to dry in the sun. As a little girl, she'd loved the army of marching clothespins, and when no one was about, she'd bury her face in the newly dried sheets. The smell, at once sweet and pungent, enchanted her. Could that be a whiff of it now? She could remember herself laughing, toddling away from the sheets, when her mother, in one graceful motion, swooped her up to the sky, it seemed, and carried her away in the crook of her arm, as if she herself were just a little bundle of clothes to be neatly arranged in the chest of drawers in her parents' bedroom. Dr. Alloway? Dr. Alloway? The technician looked down on her fluttering eyelids and shallow breathing. She blinked twice, removed the headphones, and gave him a small, apologetic smile. Sometimes her colleagues had to talk very loudly if they wished to be heard above the amplified cosmic radio noise. She would, in turn, compensate for the volume of the noise. She was loath to remove the earphones for brief conversations by shouting back. When she was sufficiently preoccupied, a casual or even convivial exchange of pleasantries would seem, to an inexperienced observer, like a fragment of a fierce and unprovoked argument, unexpectedly generated amidst the quiet of the vast radio facility. But now she only said, "Sorry, I must have drifted off." "It's Dr. Drumlin on the phone. He's in Jack's office and says he has an appointment with you." "Holy Toledo! I forgot," she said. As the years had passed, Drumlin's brilliance had remained undiminished. But there were a number of additional personal idiosyncrasies that had not been in evidence when she had served briefly as his graduate student at Caltech. For example, he had the disconcerting habit now of checking, when he thought himself unobserved, whether his fly was open. He had, over the years, become increasingly convinced that extraterrestrials did not exist, or at least that they were too rare, too distant to be detected. He had come to Argus to give the weekly scientific colloquium, but, she found, he'd come for another purpose as well. He had written a letter to the National Science Foundation urging that Argus terminate its search for extraterrestrial intelligence and devote itself full-time to more conventional radio astronomy. He produced it from an inside pocket and insisted that she read it. She said, "But we've only been at it 4.5 years. We've looked at less than a third of the northern sky. Now, this is the first survey that can do the entire radio noise minimum at optimum band passes. Now, why would you want to stop now?" "No, Ellie, this is endless. After a dozen years, you'll find no sign of anything. You'll argue that another Argus facility has to be built at a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars in Australia or Argentina to observe the southern sky. And when that fails, you'll talk about building some paraboloid with a free-flying feed in Earth orbit so you can get millimeter waves. You'll always be able to think of some kind of observation that hasn't been done. You'll always invent some explanation about why the extraterrestrials like to broadcast where we haven't looked." "Oh, Dave, we've been through this 100 times. If we fail, we learn something of the rarity of intelligent life, or at least intelligent life that thinks like we do and wants to communicate with backward civilizations like us. And if we succeed, we hit the cosmic jackpot. There's no greater discovery you can imagine. There are first-rate projects that aren't finding telescope time. There's work on quasar evolution, binary pulsars, the chromospheres of nearby stars, even those crazy interstellar proteins. These projects are waiting in line because this facility, by far the best phased array in the world, is being used almost entirely for SETI. 75% for SETI, Dave. 25% for routine radio astronomy. Don't call it routine. We've got the opportunity to look back to the time that the galaxies were being formed, or maybe even earlier than that. We can examine the cores of giant molecular clouds and the black holes at the centers of galaxies. There's a revolution in astronomy about to happen, and you're standing in the way. "Dave, try not to personalize this," she said. "Argus would never have been built if there wasn't public support for SETI. The idea for Argus isn't mine. You know, they picked me as director when the last 40 dishes were still under construction. The NSF is entirely behind... Not entirely. And not if I have anything to say about it. This is grandstanding. This is pandering to UFO cooks and comic strips and weak-minded adolescents. By now, Drumlin was fairly shouting. And Ellie felt an irresistible temptation to tune him out. Because of the nature of her work and her comparative eminence, she was constantly thrown into situations where she was the only woman present, except for those serving coffee or making a stenotypic transcript. Despite what seemed like a lifetime of effort on her part, there was still a host of male scientists who only talked to each other, insisted on interrupting her, and ignored, when they could, what she had to say. Occasionally there were those like Drumlin, who showed a positive antipathy. But at least he was treating her as he did many men. He was even-handed in his outburst, visiting them equally on the scientists of both sexes. There were a rare few of her male colleagues who did not exhibit awkward personality changes in her presence. She ought to spend more time with them, she thought. People like Kenneth Dehier, the molecular biologist from the Salk Institute, who had recently been appointed presidential science advisor, and Peter Valerian, of course. Drumlin's impatience with Argus, she knew, was shared by many astronomers. After the first 2 years, a kind of melancholy had pervaded the facility. There were passionate debates in the commissary or during the long and undemanding watches about the intentions of the putative extraterrestrials. We could not guess how different from us they might be. It was hard enough to guess the intentions of our elected representatives in Washington. What would be the intentions of fundamentally different kinds of beings on physically different worlds, hundreds or thousands of light-years away? Some believed that the signal would not be transmitted in the radio spectrum at all, but in the infrared, or the visible, or somewhere among the gamma rays. Or perhaps the extraterrestrials were signalling avidly, but with a technology we would not invent for another 1,000 years. Astronomers at other institutions were making extraordinary discoveries among the stars and the galaxies, picking out those objects which, by whatever mechanism, generated intense radio waves. Other radio astronomers published scientific papers, attended meetings, were uplifted by a sense of progress and purpose. The Argus astronomers tended not to publish and were usually ignored when the call went out for invited papers at the annual meeting of the American Astronomical Society or the triennial symposia and plenary sessions of the International Astronomical Union. So, in consultation with the National Science Foundation, the leadership at Argus had reserved 25% of the observing time for projects unconnected with the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Some important discoveries had been made. On the extragalactic objects, it seemed paradoxically to be moving faster than light. On the surface temperature of Neptune's big moon, Triton, and on the dark matter in the outer reaches of nearby galaxies where no stars could be seen. Morale began to improve. The Argus staff felt that they were making a contribution at the cutting edge of astronomical discovery. The time to complete a full search of the sky had been lengthened, it was true. But now their professional careers had some safety net. They might not succeed in finding signs of other intelligent beings, but they might pluck other secrets from the treasury of nature. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence, everywhere abbreviated to SETI, except by those who talked somewhat more optimistically about communication with extraterrestrial intelligence, CETI as against SETI, was essentially an observing routine, the dull staple for which most of the facility had been built. But a quarter of the time you could be assured of using the most powerful array of radio telescopes on Earth for other projects. You had only to get through the boring part. A small amount of time had also been reserved for astronomers from other institutions. While the morale had improved noticeably, there were many who agreed with Drumlin. They glanced longingly at the technological miracle that Argus's 131 radio telescopes represented, and imagined using them for their own, doubtless meritorious, programmes. She was alternately conciliatory and argumentative with Dave, but none of it did any good. He was not in an amiable mood. Drumlin's colloquium was in part an attempt to demonstrate that there were no extraterrestrials anywhere. If we had accomplished so much in only a few thousand years of high technology, what must a truly advanced species, he asked, be capable of? They should be able to move stars about, to reconfigure galaxies. And yet, in all of astronomy, there was no sign of a phenomenon that could not be understood by natural processes, for which an appeal to extraterrestrial intelligence had to be made. Why hadn't Argus detected a radio signal by now? Did they imagine just one radio transmitter in all of the sky? Did they realize how many billions of stars they had examined already? The experiment was a worthy one, but now it was over. They didn't have to examine the rest of the sky. The answer was in. Neither in deeper space nor near the Earth was there any sign of extraterrestrials. They did not exist. In the question period, one of the Argus astronomers asked about the zoo hypothesis. The contention that the extraterrestrials were out there, all right, but chose not to make their presence known, in order to conceal from humans the fact that there were other intelligent beings in the cosmos, in the same sense that a specialist in primate behavior might wish to observe a troop of chimpanzees in the bush, but not interfere with their activities. In reply, Drumlin asked a different question. Is it likely that with a million civilizations in the galaxy, the sort of number he said was bandied about at Argus, there would not be a single poacher? How does it come about that every civilization in the galaxy abides by an ethic of non-interference? Is it probable that not one of them would be poking around on the Earth? But on Earth, Ellie replied, poachers and game wardens have roughly equal levels of technology. If the game warden is a major step ahead, with radar and helicopters, say, then the poachers are out of business. The remark was greeted warmly by some of the Argus staff, but Drumlin only said, "You're reaching, Ellie, you're reaching." To clear her head, it was her practice to go for long solo drives. In her one extravagance, a carefully maintained 1958 Thunderbird, with a removable hardtop and a little glass porthole flanking the rear seat. Often she would leave the top at home and speed through the scrub desert at night, with the windows down and her dark hair streaming behind her. Over the years, it seemed, she had gotten to know every small, impoverished town, every boot and mazer, and every state highway patrolman in southwestern New Mexico. After a night observing Run, she would love to zoom past the Argus guard station. That was before the cyclone fencing went up, rapidly changing gears and drive north. Around Santa Fe, the faintest glimmerings of dawn might be seen above the Sangre de Cristo Mountains. Why should a religion, she asked herself, name its places after the blood and body, heart and pancreas of its most revered figure? And why not the brain, among other prominent but uncommemorative organs? This time she drove southeast, toward the Sacramento Mountains. Could Dave be right? Could SETI and Argus be a kind of collective delusion of a few insufficiently hard-nosed astronomers? Was it true that no matter how many years went by without the receipt of a message, the project would continue, always inventing a new strategy for the transmitting civilization, continually devising novel and expensive instrumentation? What would be a convincing sign of failure? When would she be willing to give up and turn to something safer, something more guaranteed of results? The Nobiyama Observatory in Japan had just announced the discovery of adenosine, a complex organic molecule, a building block of DNA, sitting out there in a dense molecular cloud. She could certainly busy herself usefully in looking for life-related molecules in space, even if she gave up searching for extraterrestrial intelligence. On the high mountain road, she glanced at the southern horizon and caught a glimpse of the constellation Centaurus. In that pattern of stars, the ancient Greeks had seen a chimerical figure, half man, half horse, who had taught Zeus wisdom. But Ellie could never make out any pattern remotely like a centaur. It was Alpha Centauri, the brightest star in the constellation that she delighted in. It was the nearest star, only 4.25 light years away. Actually, Alpha Centauri was a triple system, two suns tightly orbiting one another, and a third, more remote, circling them both. From Earth, the three stars blended together to form a solitary point of light. On particularly clear nights like this one, she could sometimes see it hovering somewhere over Mexico. Sometimes, when the air had been laden with desert grit after several consecutive days of sandstorms, she would drive up into the mountains to gain a little altitude and atmospheric transparency, get out of the car, and stare at the nearest star system. Planets were possibly there, although very hard to detect. Some might be closely orbiting any one of the triple suns. A more interesting orbit, with some fair celestial mechanical stability, was a figure eight, which wrapped itself around the two inner suns. What would it be like, she wondered, to live on a world with three suns in the sky? Probably even hotter than New Mexico. The two-lane blacktop highway, Ellie noticed, with a pleasant little tremor, was lined with rabbits. She'd seen them before, especially when her drives had taken her as far as West Texas. They were on all fours by the shoulders of the road, but as each would be momentarily illuminated by the Thunderbird's new quartz headlights, it would simply stand on its hind legs, its forelimbs hanging limply, transfixed. For miles there was an honour guard of desert conies, saluting her, so it seemed, as she roared through the night. They would look up, 1,000 pink noses twitching, 2,000 bright eyes shining in the dark, as this apparition hurtled towards them. Maybe it's a kind of religious experience, she thought. They seemed to be mostly young rabbits. Maybe they'd never seen automobile headlights. To think of it, it was pretty amazing, the two intense beams of light speeding along at 130 kilometres an hour. Despite the thousands of rabbits lining the road, there never seemed to be even one in the middle, near the lane marker. Never a confused scurrying out of the way, never a forlorn dead body, the ears stretched out along the pavement. Why were they aligned along the pavement at all? Maybe it had to do with the temperature of the asphalt, she thought. Or maybe they were only foraging in the scrub vegetation nearby and curious about the oncoming bright lights. But was it reasonable that none of them ever took a few short hops to visit his cousins across the road? What did they imagine the highway was? An alien presence in their midst, its function unfathomable, built by creatures that most of them had never seen? She doubted that any of them wondered about it at all. The whine of her tires on the highway was a kind of white noise, and she found that involuntarily she was here, too, listening for a pattern. She had taken to listening closely to many sources of white noise, the motor of the refrigerator starting up in the middle of the night, the water running for a bath, the washing machine when she would do her clothes in the little laundry room off her kitchen, the roar of the ocean during a brief scuba diving trip to the island of Cozumel off Yucatan, which she'd cut short because of her impatience to get back to work. She would listen to these everyday sources of random noise and try to determine whether there were fewer apparent patterns in them than in the interstellar static. She'd been to New York City the previous August for a meeting of URSI, URSI, the French abbreviation for the International Scientific Radio Union. The subways were dangerous, she had been told, but the white noise was irresistible. In the clacker-clacker of this underground railway, she'd thought she heard a clue, and resolutely skipped half a day of meetings, travelling from 34th Street to Coney Island, back to Midtown Manhattan, and then on a different line, out to remotest Queens. She changed trains at a station in Jamaica, and then returned, a little flushed and breathless. It was, after all, a hot day in August, she told herself, to the Convention Hotel. Sometimes, when the subway train was banking around a steep curve, the interior bulbs would go out, and she could see a regular succession of lights glowing in electric blue, speeding by as if she were in some impossible, hyper-relativistic interstellar spacecraft, hurtling through a cluster of young, blue, supergiant stars. Then, as the train entered a straightaway, the interior lights would come on again, and she would become aware once again of the acrid smell, the jostlings of nearby step-hangers, the miniature television surveillance cameras locked in protective cages and subsequently spray-painted blind, the stylized multicolored map showing the complete underground transportation system of the city of New York, and the high-frequency screech of the brakes as they pulled into the stations. Now, this was a little eccentric, she knew, but she had always had an active fantasy life. All right. So she was a little compulsive about listening to noise. It did no harm, that she could see. Nobody seemed to notice much. Anyway, it was job-related. If she had been so minded, she could probably have deducted the expense of her trip to Cozumel from her income tax because of the sound of the breakers. Well, maybe she was becoming obsessive. She realized with a start that she had arrived at the Rockefeller Center station. As she quickly stepped out through an accumulation of daily newspapers abandoned on the floor of the subway car, a headline of the News Post had caught her eye. "Guerrillas capture Joburg radio." If we like them, they're freedom fighters, she thought. If we don't like them, they're terrorists. In the unlikely case we can't make up our minds, they're temporarily only guerrillas. On an adjacent scrap of newspaper was a large photo of a florid, confident man with a headline, "How the World Will End," excerpts from the Reverend Billy Joe Rankin's new book, exclusively this week in the News Post. She had taken the headlines in at a glance and tried promptly to forget them. Moving through the bustling crowds to the meeting hotel, she hoped she was in time to hear Fujita's paper on the homomorphic radio telescope design. Superposed on the whine of the tires was a periodic thump at the joins of swathes of pavement, which had been resurfaced by different New Mexico road crews in different epochs. She thought, what if an interstellar message were being received by Project Argus, but very slowly, one bit of information every hour, say, or every week, or every decade? What if there were very old, very patient murmurs of some transmitting civilization which had no way of knowing that we get tired of pattern recognition after seconds or minutes? Suppose they lived for tens of thousands of years and talked very slowly. Well, Argus would never know. Could such long-lived creatures exist? Would there have been enough time in the history of the universe for creatures who reproduced very slowly to evolve to high intelligence? Wouldn't the statistical breakdown of chemical bonds, the deterioration of their bodies, according to the second law of thermodynamics, force them to reproduce about as often as human beings do, and to have lifespans like ours? Or might they reside on some old and frigid world where even molecular collisions occur in extreme slow motion, maybe only a frame a day? She idly imagined a radio transmitter of recognizable and familiar design sitting on a cliff of methane ice, feebly illuminated by a distant red dwarf sun, while far below waves of an ammonia ocean beat relentlessly against the shore, incidentally generating a white noise indistinguishable from that of the surf at Cozumel. The opposite was possible as well. The fast talkers, manic little creatures, perhaps, moving with quick and jerky motions, who transmitted a complete radio message, the equivalent of hundreds of pages of English text, in a nanosecond. Of course, if you had a very narrow band pass to your receiver, so you were listening only to a tiny range of frequencies, you were forced to accept the long time constant. You would never be able to detect a rapid modulation. It was a simple consequence of the Fourier integral theorem and closely related to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So, for example, if you had a bandpass of a kilohertz, you couldn't make out a signal that was modulated at faster than a millisecond. It would be a kind of sonic blur. The Argus bandpasses were narrower than a hertz, so, to be detected, the transmitters must be modulating very slowly. Slower than one bit of information a second. Still slower modulations, longer than hours, say, could be detected easily, provided you were willing to point a telescope at the source for that length of time, provided you were exceptionally patient. There were so many pieces of the sky to look at, so many hundreds of billions of stars to search them. You could spend all your time on only a few of them. She was troubled that in their haste to do a full sky survey in less than a human lifetime, to listen to all of the sky at a billion frequencies, they had abandoned both the frantic talkers and the laconic plodders. But surely, she thought, they would know better than we what modulation frequencies were acceptable. They would have had previous experience with interstellar communication and newly emerging civilizations. If there was a broad range of likely pulse rates that the receiving civilization would adopt, well, the transmitting civilization would utilize such a range, modulate at microseconds, modulate at hours. What would it cost them? They would, almost all of them, have superior engineering and enormous power resources by Earth standards. If they wanted to communicate with us, they would make it easy for us. They would send signals at many different frequencies. They would use many different modulation timescales. They would know how backward we are and would have pity. So, why had we received no signal? She thought. Could Dave possibly be right? No extraterrestrial civilizations anywhere. All those billions of worlds going to waste, lifeless, barren. Intelligent beings growing up only in this obscure corner of an incomprehensibly vast universe. No matter how valiantly she tried, Ellie couldn't make herself take such a possibility seriously. It dovetailed perfectly with human fears and pretensions, with unproved doctrines about life after death, with such pseudosciences as astrology. It was the modern incarnation of the geocentric solipsism, the conceit that had captured our ancestors, the notion that we were the center of the universe. Drumlin's argument was suspect on these grounds alone. We wanted to believe it too badly. Wait a minute, she thought. We haven't even examined the northern skies once with the Argus system. In another 7 or 8 years, if we've still heard nothing, that'll be the time to start worrying. This is the first moment in human history when it's possible to search for the inhabitants of other worlds. If we fail, we've calibrated something of the rarity and preciousness of life on our planet. A fact, if it is one, very much worth knowing. And if we succeed, we'll have changed the history of our species, broken the shackles of provincialism. With the stakes this high, you have to be willing to take some small professional risks, she told herself. She pulled off the side of the road and did a shallow racing turn, changed gears twice, and accelerated back toward the Argus facility. The rabbits, still lining the roadside, but now pinked by the dawn, craned their necks to follow her departure.